all the preparation I do beforehand and all this fancy looking at data, that will not help you out there in the field. I never expected, like on Tour Divide, in this Great Divide Basin and this peanut butter mud, we didn't progress of 1 mile per hour. And there is no support vehicle or anything out there. Nobody is helping you. And then, well, a porta potty shows up and you're the luckiest person on the planet that you find a place to hide, actually with two other men. So three full-grown men sitting in a porta potty for 12 hours. That's nothing you prepare for. You need to get the capability to adapt to it. Let's say it like this.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Coming up, Ulrich Bartholomew's. Someone that I connected with over social media shortly after we got to Girona. He and I exchanged a few messages after his epic win in the Tour Divide this past summer, and met up for coffee shortly after we got here to Girona. Had a really nice conversation, one of those kind of coffee shop conversations that inspired this podcast project to begin with. Just kind of shooting the breeze, telling stories, comparing notes. Really had a good time, and recording a podcast was just a very natural extension of that. Although for a minute there, we thought it might not happen. Ulrich had a big crash at his first race of the year, the Atlas Mountain Race, and was in the hospital for a few days, but is now recovering well. And we were able to record this podcast before we leave Girona for the winter. We've only got about a week here left. And I'm really glad we were able to get this podcast done because along with being an absolutely incredible endurance athlete, Ulrich is a fabulous storyteller. This was one of those conversations that just rolled so easily, and it felt like we were really only scratching the surface. So I think there will be at least another, if not multiple, more installments of podcasts with Ulrich. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. This one's a gem. Catch you after the show.
Okay, Ulrich, give us your last name, because I'm not positive.
Oh, that's Ulrich Bartholmus.
Bartholomew's.
Yeah, that's perfect. You nice. Hit it.
How are you feeling?
Good, good. I had a little accident 2 weeks ago in Morocco. It turned out to be a bit more serious than I thought. I thought about annoying broken rib, but it turned out to be a pneumothorax, a collapsed lung. So it was definitely more serious than I expected. I was in hospital for 3 days, and now almost back to kind of normal. So since 3 days, I'm back on the bike doing like easy spins for 1.5-2 hours, which feels super, super good and super happy about it. And I will take it easy for another 1 or 2 weeks. But given that I had this kind of shocking news of a collapsed lung, which my right lung had the size of a fist, which was smaller than I expected.
Yeah, that's pretty small as far as lungs go.
Yeah.
Yikes.
So this was pretty shocking. And given that this is like 1.5 weeks ago or something.
How big is your lung right now?
It's back to normal. It went, so they in the hospital, after they saw it on the X-ray, they put a tube into my chest between the ribs, And that lets the air out, which is like part of the pneumothorax. There's air in the chest and
in the cavity instead of in the lung.
Yeah. And it compresses the lung basically. And as soon as the air gets out, normally it takes like 24 hours to get the lung back to the normal size. For me, it happened in less than like 30 minutes. They took an X-ray to just check if this tube they inserted is like placed correctly. And you already could see that the lung was basically back to like normal size.
Wow.
So it was...
Did that surprise them? Did it seem like?
My whole appearance there surprised them totally, because they said normally if you have a collapsed lung, you feel it after walking 3 stairs or something. You will be out of breath after 3 stairs. You will clearly feel it. And I was walking around like normal. Mm. Even in the morning, I was riding my bike to a coffee place and was just acting and moving like normal. I felt absolutely nothing.
You weren't no shortness of breath or anything?
Nothing. I had just this pain in the ribs when I was coughing, which was normal for having a broken rib, which I assumed to have. And that's why I was not worried at all. And I had no shortage on breathing and nothing. I felt super normal. So I was super shocked when they said like, oh, the lung is smaller than expected.
Wow. I'd also like to acknowledge that this is probably the most 0 to 60 we've ever gotten in a podcast. We haven't talked about the weather. We're already into the granular details of a pneumothorax 3 minutes in. So I like this already, but... we should, for those that just hit play and didn't read the description of this episode, we should probably explain that you are in Morocco because you're a professional bike pack racer and we're doing your first race of the season. The race was a couple of weeks ago, so we'll get into this, but it's one thing I've noticed about you is you seem to approach your racing and your career and the athletic components of being as good a cyclist as you can be maybe more high performance and traditional cycling sort of inspired than many of your bikepacking peers. And that seems to be the case. I mean, you tell me, but with the way you structure your season a little bit too, for most professional cyclists, February is kind of when you start doing your preseason races or kicking off your season. And they're the races that are, you know, important races, but they're part of the build towards your main goals for the year. And I take it that's what the Atlas Mountain race was for you as well a couple of weeks ago. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's totally correct. So Atlas Mountain race, early February, for me also was a thing to get through the winter. I always need like any nearby goal and something to train for and to concentrate on. And as this bikepacking and ultra long distance racing things, they don't happen that often like other races where you have one every Saturday or one every Sunday. And so you need to be a bit more selective on the calendar, and given the fact that they run through multiple days, let's say they typically start at least like in our hemisphere, they start like in spring when weather gets better and more stable and night gets shorter and stuff like this. So it's always a bit tricky to find something which is early in the year, because I'm not able to wait for the first race till April or May. That's too long.
Yeah. So what happened with the crash?
Yeah, actually the crash was just the end, almost the end of the story, because it happened 85 kilometers before the finish line, and the race has a total distance of 1,300 kilometers. So it began actually already pretty, let's say, adventurous, because I had... let's say some wrong food 3 or 4 days before the race. So I spent a bit more time nearby a toilet than I wished to. And but that's kind of normal, or well, not normal, but it can happen in Morocco. So you drink only bottled water, and I had a salad which was washed in tap water, which was a terrible idea. Well, you learn things. So I learned about the salad. And I deeply regretted it. So that was the one thing which kind of impacted the start of the race. And the other thing was actually the weather in Morocco. It did not rain at all in Marrakesh for 5 months. Wow. And the day when the race was supposed to start, it had super, super heavy rain. And I mean, bike pack racing and this ultra long distance racing, people bring good kit and good gear. So sure, it's not fun riding in the rain, but it's part of the game and you just do it.
There's no extreme weather protocol like in the World Tour.
There is nothing like this. But the thing was not if people are willing to ride in the rain. The thing was more that the route gets issues with flash floods. So if it's not raining for 5 months and then you put like a ton of rain down, and dry riverbeds will become proper rivers. And there were two sections in the beginning of the race where this was a problem. So the race organizer had to create reroutings to just don't pass those riverbeds. Then the government officials thought it's too dangerous. So in the end, the start of the race was postponed for 24 hours. It was the very first time, and I did 25 of this kind of ultra long distance bikepacking races the last year, so quite some. I never saw that a race was postponed because of the weather. It was crazy. But anyway, so this affected the start a bit, as well as my stomach issues. So the 24 hours delay was helping me a bit, but I was still not over it. So the first day for me was literally, if I can say this, it was literally shit. But it got better within the first 24 hours. And I guess on the second or third day, I was back in the top three. And finally, even after having this crash with a dog, 85 kilometers out of the finish line, and riding the rest of it with what I thought is a broken rib, and it was not painful, but it was not comfortable, let's say it like this. You just try to get to the finish line, and I did this and finished the race placing second after less than 4 days, 4 minutes less than 4 days. Which was a super nice topping.
Yeah.
And
not bad, especially with one lung.
Yeah. As well.
So the crash happened because you had a dog.
Yeah. There were a few dogs chasing me, and one just followed me a bit on the right side. He looked like a nice guy and was just following me. And at some point he decided to turn left, like instant into my front wheel.
Oh God.
And I was like, why? And I was not going fast, maybe 20 kilometers an hour or something, but I had no chance to brake because I was like cruising and the dog was right next to me. So I didn't expect that anything to happen, and it all happened within like less than a second. So yeah. I just hit the deck and the bike was on my back and I was totally crippled on the asphalt. I don't know.
Ugh.
And obviously hit the deck with the chest pretty hard, and did some more damage than I expected.
Yeah.
In the end, it turned out I had no broken rib. So there was nothing, there was no bone or anything puncturing the lung. Still there was something where the air out of the lung leaked. And that's why I also made jokes about it and said, like, oh, I'm not running tubeless anymore.
So I
had a tube inserted. So that was super annoying, and made jokes about tubeless and tubes and leaking things and sealant and fixing it. And
yeah, I remember that. Okay, so speaking of your social media, that was a funny post, but where I first became familiar with you, and probably where a lot of people became familiar with you over the last year, was in this epic battle that you had during the Tour Divide race with Justinus.
Yeah.
Was Justinus's last name again?
Justinus Laveca.
Laveca. And he's from East, is he from Eastern Europe?
He's from Lithuania. But living in Norway.
Norway, okay. So you and he had this incredible back and forth battle during the Tour Divide, and the Tour Divide is a race that I really enjoy following every year, and it's a race that I think obviously many people enjoy following. And it's interesting how the evolution of how fans can follow it has kind of progressed. And at first it was just dot watching, and now it's kind of dot watching plus the rider's social media. And I remember, because at first I just would see a name, you know, I saw Ulrich, I saw Justinus, and I started wondering, you know, who are these guys? And you start kind of doing a little bit of research and then pull up your social media, and you had some fun stories here and there, but obviously you're pretty focused on doing the actual bike riding part. So you'd maybe have a story here, story there, not a whole lot. But as I started following you post that race, and I'm sure we'll spend plenty of time talking about that race, but even once that race was over with, which you ended up winning, and I was still following you and kind of curious about what you were up to, it became quickly apparent that you have a little bit of a different approach to bike pack racing than many other bike pack racers. And where that was really brought into focus was actually pretty recently, because we met for coffee here in Girona in January, I think it was.
Yeah.
We sat down for coffee and I was a little bit kind of bleary-eyed, I think, and you were already there maybe, but you were all bright-eyed, and I was like, this guy's already been doing stuff today for sure. let's see what he's accomplished today. And you said you'd just come back from doing a metabolic test.
Yeah.
And you showed me a photo. So for those that don't know, a metabolic test in cycling and endurance sports is a pretty common thing where you basically are determining how efficient the body runs. So carbohydrate utilization versus fat utilization, all that sort of thing. And usually you do it while exercising because you're trying to figure out how efficiently the engine runs. But the photo you showed me, you were literally laying in a chair with your eyes closed, but with the mask on, the gas exchange mask.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, this is different. I've never seen anything like this. And are you good talking about all this? Cause it's,
sure.
I don't know if anyone else is doing this. My understanding is you were figuring out the requirements of recovery during these multi-day races and how efficiently your body is recovering, the time periods that you can, basically how long you need to sleep, where the inflection points are, where you really get recovery. Can you cut sleep here? Do you need to add sleep? What is the body doing when it's really under duress and trying to recover from 18, 20, 22 hour ride days? And that's when I was like, whoa, this guy is going full gas on the science side of things. That's one of the things that I was most excited to talk about today. So when did that start coming into the picture for you? And can you just give us a window into everything you're up to and why, and like why you want to take almost like a world tour mindset to bike pack racing?
Yeah. So I started bike pack racing in 2019, and my first race, you can literally say I went there with absolutely no clue what I'm doing. because I was traveling here through Spain with my camper van in the summer, and I was looking for any like Gran Fondo kind race nearby, but it's not existing here. And the only thing I found was a thing called Transpyrenees, and that was 950 kilometers.
That's a pretty big Gran Fondo.
That was a big Gran Fondo, actually. Yeah. But anyway, I thought like, yeah, let's try this. This sounds interesting. And it was Transpyrenees from east to west through the Pyrenees, covering all this mystic climbs, you know, from Tour de France and from the La Vuelta. And it was a great thing. So I did this, and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing and how long it will take me. I even had a goddamn shaver with me. I didn't thought about it. I had like a big saddle pack full with stuff.
Like an electric?
No, a normal razor. Shaver, okay. A razor, yeah. But it's just as simple as I had absolutely no idea, yeah. Like if it's going to take like 2 days, a week, whatever. I don't know. And that's where it all started. And I ended up, even with this razor with me, I ended up winning this race, my very first race. And then it got quite some traction, and I had some more successful races afterwards. And I'm kind of like a curious, maybe a bit nerdy person. So I always try to improve in a very structured way. So I started thinking about my gear, and I reduced my gear, and next race I didn't take a razor with me. And so it all started. So I left home the, let's say, useless items. And that was where it started. And I thought about efficiency, about stopping time, about sleeping time, about stuff like this. Then 2 years ago, I started working more on the training side. So getting a more structured training approach. And basically, you can say every year I try to set one big thing where I want to change and improve things for me significantly. Mm. And yeah, that's a totally different approach than other people's take. Other people take it like as an adventure and let's just see what happens. And that's fun. And for me, it's fun to spend all the time in thinking about where I can improve and where I can. And I basically do it for myself, like just to see the progress and just to learn things. And this year, one thing I'm working on is the nutrition aspect. What the body actually needs and what the body actually can take in a 4-day race. And that for sure has significant impact on recovery and how long you need and how weak you feel or not weak you feel. And what you mentioned there, what I did was a test where you basically, you rest and with the gas mask, you determine the amount of calories the body needs in rest. So just laying the full day in bed or on the couch, how much does the engine need for just laying there? And from this point, with a few other values, you can determine what you need in specific zones in cycling or in efforts in general. And then you can start thinking about what the body needs on day 1, 2, 3 of racing, ultra long distance things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting because from the outside and as a fan of bike pack racing, oftentimes it seems like as these events are going on, you know, the community is dot watching and they will see an athlete just decide to kind of flip a switch and go for it. And it's almost like an extra long slow speed attack, feel like I'm gonna sleep 2 hours less. I'm pushing the pace, you know. It's like it's an interesting thing, and for the the longest time, it seems like there's been what's celebrated, of course, and it makes sense, is just the sheer grit, the willpower, the willingness to cut sleep, the willingness to ride through a heinous storm, the willingness to take a gamble on when you refuel, and then maybe you ride through the night instead of sleeping in a place where typically people take advantage of a hotel that's en route. All of these strategic maneuvers that oftentimes seem to come back to toughness,
yeah,
mental resilience, all these things. I've dipped my toe into this sort of effort just enough to know how much the pendulum does swing in that direction. Like, there's obviously the athletic component is front and center, but the mental athleticism, if I don't know if that's a thing, but so much of the emphasis goes towards just sheer willpower and grit with these events. But at a certain point, like, everyone's really, really tough.
Yeah.
Everyone is hard as rocks. Do you feel like this physiological component, like the science, is that an untapped area that's going to kind of open new doors athletically with bike pack racing? Do you think that there's a lot to gain there?
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, there is a lot of knowledge existing on, let's say, classic world tour 1 day racing. So how much carbs can you fuel in 1 hour? And you see the evolution there. Like, years back, it was, I don't know, 80. Then it was 90 grams. Then it was like 100. Now we are talking like 110, 120. And there is a lot of science and knowledge available in this thing. But at the same point, you have to acknowledge it's not physically possible to fuel 120 or even 100, whatever, grams of carbs per hour for 24 consecutive hours. And then again, and then again, and again. It's just not working. Not with gels, not with bars, not with proper food. It's simply not working.
Your body can't absorb that.
It can't absorb. There's a minimum and there's a maximum threshold what the body can absorb and can process, and the rest is just waste.
Yep.
And to understand this and to see how it actually converts with different other factors like rest and sleep to ride faster, that's a super... That's an area there is not so much knowledge available. And for quite a fair period of time, it was all about cutting sleep. And then a few guys, like you saw last year, what Lachlan also did on the divide, getting 6 hours of rest every night. And let's say he rode damn fast. And there you can see every person also has a threshold on the amount of rest, which you can put together with a good fueling, and then the magic happens. And I think to get a better understanding of this threshold, of this sweet spot, makes racing more interesting. And makes it for sure also more fun, because you simply suffer less. And that's what I'm trying to find out. And it's a bit more complicated in this ultra long distance racing, because I don't know, if you go for a 1 day race, like 4 or 5 hours, you can test plenty of things. And if you are up for it, you can again race tomorrow, if it's a stage race, and you can tomorrow test different things, and the day after again. But on this multi-day racing events, you cannot test every day something totally different. So it takes a longer period of time to gain knowledge on how things work together in combination. And that makes it so interesting. And I think there is still a lot of potential and a lot of stuff that we don't know, and which simply nobody knows, because I mean, this ultra long distance racing, it's a niche in a niche in a niche. Yeah. And there is not such a thing like big budget world tour teams. They send scientists and nutritionists and people like thinking about it. So there are people like me starting to think about it and starting to build some knowledge there. But it's still a pretty young sport, even if it's existing since, I don't know, maybe 10 years. But also coming from the fact that it's more an adventurous kind of thing, there's not so much, let's say, scientific knowledge.
Yeah. So as someone that really enjoys putting together a plan and controlling as many variables as you can, you know, that's all well and good until you get to day 10 and you're hiding in a porta potty because you're freezing cold and there's some crazy storm, you know, in the Great Basin or wherever it was.
Yeah.
Or you're in an epic battle with another guy who's really well prepared and really, really wants to win and willing to start cutting sleep. And you may know that your ideal sweet spot for performance is 4 hours of sleep. But if you take 4 hours of sleep, you're not going to win. So what is it like for you who loves this process and putting together all the pieces to get into a situation like that? And we can use Tour Divide as an example. I don't know. I'm sure it sounds like you're educating yourself at such a rate that already since that race back in June last year, already things have evolved hugely for you in regards to the way you're going to approach things. But even taking yourself back to that race where you're in this awesome battle, adverse conditions, you had the opportunity to achieve what I assume you consider the greatest race of your career so far.
Yeah.
Was there any part of you that was, how much time are you spending? I know what works for me. I need to stick with that. And how much is getting to this very primal fight or flight? I just really want to beat the guy that's next to me and he's not going away.
Yeah. I mean, all the preparation I do beforehand and all this fancy looking at data, doing science things, that will not help you out there in the field, not in the moment when you are out in the goddamn storm. but what it does for me, it gives me confidence and it controls a few variables that are around the whole thing. So I know my system, my body really well. And I know also from the experience how far I can go and where are the boundaries and where I might take too much risk or not. And I can calculate, I feel I can calculate the risk better, and also I can calculate more in advance, exactly to this point where I can think like, yeah, I can still ride 2 days and then the last, I don't know, 700 miles, I can go without sleep and just push through it, whatever.
700 miles.
Why not? Yeah. Ooh. And this
is that what you did?
No, I didn't, because I didn't need to, but okay. that was a kind of a plan B, which I at some point, calculated or considered if it's still very, very tight, we can, like, as you said, push it more on this really slow moving attack kind of style.
Yeah, and a bike pack attack.
Yeah, a bike pack attack. Yeah.
Someone needs to make a t-shirt.
Yeah. And that's that helps me to let's say control the situation for myself and know what I'm capable of, and that makes me a bit more flexible and confident in this kind of situations where you're just out there in a storm, in a porta potty or whatever, where actually nothing of this fancy science and whatever you tested values, it's not helping. And that's fun as well to combine those two aspects. You can prepare a lot and you can think a lot about how to do well in situations, but you still need to have the ability just to react and just to be flexible, to react on something which you never expected. And I never expected, like on Tour Divide, in this great Divide basin and this peanut butter mud, we didn't progress of 1 mile per hour. And this for hours, and we were literally in the middle of it, and 70 miles to the one end, 70 miles going back to the other end, and making 1 mile progress. And then you start calculating. I still had plenty of food, but 70 hours, 1 mile per hour, you will not survive this. I had not food for 70 goddamn hours. So I had, my initial expectations were like, it will, like in normal conditions, 8 to 9 hours to cross the basin. Worst case calculation was 16, 17 hours if something happens and I had enough food for this period. In the end, it took 26. And then you start not eating here and there and just saving your food and saving your water. And you still need to, you need to react on this, on unplanned things. And there is no support vehicle or anything out there. Nobody's helping you. And then, well, a porta potty shows up and you're the luckiest person on the planet that you find a place to hide, actually with two other men. So three full grown men sitting in a 1 by 1 meter porta potty for 12 hours. Yeah. That's nothing you prepare for, and that's nothing you think about in advance or something. That just happens. You need to get the capability to adapt to it. Let's say it like this.
That was the pinnacle of the pinnacle of your sport that year. Three men in the Tour Divide,
yeah,
battling it out, hiding in a porta potty together.
Yeah. And literally everyone who passed there afterwards, I think literally everyone stopped there and took a selfie with this porta potty. The internet was full of people taking a selfie in front of this porta potty. I don't know.
So you took shelter because it was still raining and really cold?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it was not super cold. It had 7-8 degrees Celsius. It was raining. It was windy, and the issue is just if you don't move, you get hypothermic,
yeah,
in a short amount of time, and that's not a nice situation out there. Yeah.
Can you take us inside the porta potty for a moment? Because I think it's interesting how when you're doing something really, really hard and you're doing it for a long time, you know, mentally you kind of, I think of it as sort of hunkering down, you know, your world gets simpler. You're thinking about forward progress. I haven't been in a multi-day effort like that with other people, only solo. And I really appreciate those experiences of doing them alone, because it does take your mind such interesting places. When you're all experiencing the same thing together and it's so hellish, what's the conversation like when you find that porta potty and you're there together and there's no easy out? You're all presumably kind of running out of food, running out of water. You can't go back. Going forward, about as slow as you can imagine. What sort of conversation did you have with those two other guys?
Well, I mean, normally this kind of races are, as you said, you're alone most of the time. And that we ended up, the three race leaders in this basin, in this porta potty, all together, it was just an incredible moment. But
that's such a ridiculous thing to say. It's so true, but the fact that it worked out that way is incredible.
Yeah.
But to describe it as an incredible moment, and I was trying to keep a straight face, but you were kind of somberly describing this incredible moment, and I was like, yes.
Yeah.
In the moment, I'm sure it felt incredible, but
it's strange. It's strange indeed. But to be honest, there was no deep, no philosophical conversation ongoing.
Yeah.
It was just three guys literally trying to survive. Yeah. And we agreed, I don't know, an hour or something before the porta potty on a kind of, let's go through this together for this night. Because it was obvious that we were so slow that nobody of us had like enough resources. And we were discussing things. When is it actually the moment to call for help? And we also decided like just to keep an eye on each other, and we decided just to move on, because stopping like out there was, even with the emergency kit and sleeping kit and everything that we carried, it would not have been healthy. So we decided just to keep moving and just to keep an eye on each other. And then finding this porta potty was just a relief, and there was no discussion or anything if we all three can fit in there. It just happened. We were in there immediately, and the bikes were like put on the side outside.
Yeah.
And we all three wrapped us into our emergency BBs, and we were kind of sitting on this, all three on this toilet chair, which was 1 meter wide. And
I bet it felt amazing. I bet it got warm quickly.
It helped warming. Yeah, it was still not super cozy, but it got kind of a living room. So actually, the porta potty was quite clean. It didn't smell or feel like a toilet.
Yeah.
So we were sitting in there and we were eating chips and whatever we had. So you had to eat. You have to eat all the time. Yeah. And so we spent the night there. And it was not only, we were not waiting for like the rain to stop or whatever. We were waiting for the ground to dry.
Right.
And we went out, I don't know, from 6 a.m. we went out every hour trying to push the bikes for like a meter, seeing like, nah, it's not working, back into the living room.
Yeah. Were you able to actually fall asleep sitting upright like that?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I mean, it was not proper sleeping where you afterwards get up and feel rested, but we were all kind of sleeping, or however you call it. Yeah.
Wow. Did it ever get to the point where you felt scared about the situation?
Before we found the porta potty, definitely yes. That was the moment when I thought, for me, when the moment has come to call for help with my Garmin inReach or whatever. And normally you think about it, I don't know, in high altitude, you get stuck in a snowstorm or whatever, and then you call for help. But I was never thinking about in a flat landscape.
Yeah.
It was just ridiculous. And this was kind of scary when I realized that it's like 70 miles to go and the progress is so slow that I will not arrive. If the weather stays like this, I will not arrive till, I don't know, in 3 days. And that was scary. But at the same point, I realized it doesn't get better. when you are scared. You just have to make progress, whatever it takes, and just carry on, even if it's slow, and then see maybe weather gets better or the ground gets drier or whatever, or you find a porta potty. And I mean, being scared and just sitting there being scared is kind of wasting time and resources.
So obviously you don't do these events to seek out moments like that, but they are inevitable to an extent. I mean, you've done enough of these at this point that I'm sure you've had different versions of that Great Basin debacle.
More or less.
Yeah. Why do you think you keep coming back? Like, what has you hooked on this version of bike racing?
I think it's all about the freedom you experience. So you are on your own. It's a different when you are out there racing. It's a totally different lifestyle, a much more simple one, as you said. You care about where to get food, where can I sleep, and how far can I ride, and what can I experience during riding. And that's so much more simple than what I experience in my like normal day-to-day life, when you have your phone here and there and you have meetings and you have this and that and you have to be here and there, and like the whole life is so busy, and it has such a high, it's high speed just all the time. And this kind of bike pack racing is just slowing things down and it's simplifying things. And that is what I like about it, and why I still come back and do more and more. It's this kind of freedom. You are just out there on your own. And the exciting thing is that you find out what you are capable of, and you find out that you can do this Great Divide Basin thing. Or, I mean, I have, I don't know, dozens of stories to tell what I found out. On Atlas Mountain Race, I found out I was in the second night. I slept in it was not a hotel. It was, let's say, it was a house, and I slept in the first floor, and they locked me in. They locked the main door, and the owners were not living in the house. It was their shop, and upstairs they had a room, so I was locked in there at 2 a.m. in the morning. So I found out...
they should have known that you like to ride your bike at 2 a.m. Come on.
Yeah, that's the point. It's hard to explain to people. but I found out, and the first floor was... it was an old building, and the first floor was maybe like 4 meters high. And I found out that I can climb with my bike on the back. I can climb down from the first floor in the middle of the night and continue racing if I need to.
So you escaped?
Yeah, I escaped.
How did you get out, sorry? And how much time did you spend figuring out how to jailbreak so you could keep racing?
It took me maybe 15 minutes to figure out and maybe another 10 minutes to execute. I mean, I got up, I wanted to leave the house at the main door, which was a proper steel door, and it was massively locked, no chance to break it.
That was the first option, break the door.
That was the first option, not working. So the second option was you need to find a way to climb down. So the first thing I did, and... It happens pretty structured in my mind. Okay, you need to climb down somehow. You need to find a rope. So I was looking for any kind of cable or rope or whatever you can fix somewhere. You can leave your bike down and then just kind of climb down. There was no rope, there was no cable, there was no nothing. But I figured out that there is an option if I climb with my bike on the back from the balcony to the balcony of the next house.
What?
There is an option to climb down from the balcony from the next house, because in front of their balcony, they had like a 2 meter high container which was the total height was about 4 meters.
Okay.
And there was a container which was 2 meters high.
So for the Americans listening, you still had 6 feet to jump.
Yeah. So, but you could climb in 2 steps, basically. So, yeah.
You know what this sounds like? So there's an account on Twitter that I love very much called Out of Context Cycling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know it?
No, but...
Okay, so it's just screenshots taken from different races where weird stuff is happening. So maybe the other day there was one where a rider crashed, his bike wasn't rideable anymore, so there's 2 Astana guys riding a bike together.
Oh, yeah.
So mm-hmm. Out of context, World Tour race, 2 guys on the same bike, what's going on here? Bikepacking is just like one huge out of context bike experiences thing.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like what you're describing almost sounds like a weird like video game.
Yes.
Like you're in this escape room. Once you clear this level, you have to clear the level where you get in the porta potty with 3 guys.
Yeah.
It's so many weird experiences, so many incredible stories.
Yeah. And that's, I can fill a book with this kind of stories. And that's part of the fascination of this kind of racing, because you need so many skills that you don't prepare and that you don't train.
Yeah.
And at some point you just end up being stuck in the building and you need to escape. And then you figure out how. In the middle of the night, it's still 2:30 a.m.
Yeah.
After a proper 3-hour sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it... Those are things money can't buy.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
And this only happens in this kind of wild places, and only if you are like in this race mode.
Yeah,
because,
yeah, true.
Because normally, if you wake up, if you are bike touring and you wake up and the building is locked, you just wait. You just say, oh, another 1.5 hours sleep or another 2 hours sleep. Ah, nice, lay down again. And yeah, just wait for it. But in this race mode where you have your plan, I just had my 3 hours of sleep and there were dogs barking. It was not an option to have another hour because I was not able to sleep anyway. So I wanted to go. And then you realize the door is locked. You don't say, oh, okay, maybe lay down again and have another nap. You find your way. You have to continue. It's a race.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it so special.
Yeah. Yeah, that mindset of forward progress, no matter what, is very powerful. So one other thing I'm interested in is, so when you go to a faraway land to race, you have a rich experience like this that's almost like, it can feel like you're entering a parallel universe. Like many of the same rules that govern normal life govern that experience, but you end up on these very weird side quests also. As you re-enter the more typical world, there's an adjustment phase. Mm-hmm. Flying back from the Tour Divide, you know, you had an international flight. You had a period of time to kind of digest what happened before you got back home here to northern Spain. But one thing that I love about Europe is that there's so many incredible adventure opportunities, landscapes, bike racing opportunities in a pretty small circumference. So mm-hmm. even the Atlas Mountain Race is a very short flight away from Spain.
Yeah.
Do you ever struggle with that re-entry? Like when you finish the Atlas, that's not a good example because you had this medical issue, but pick another race where you raced, could be on the shorter side, you know, 3 days, could be longer, Silk Road, whatever, and you get home pretty quickly. Are you able to just like stroll into La Comuna the next day and order a cappuccino, or is there a couple of days of buffer that you have to create? Like what's the reentry process like to normal life?
for me on this kind of races that are like 4 days, 5, 6, 7 days, something like this, it's still kind of normal. And yeah, I can just walk into a cafe and enjoy like a proper treat of a nice cookie and a coffee. That's fine. But for example, on Tour Divide, which took 14 days, I had a pretty good time right after the race, spending near the finish line with Jeffrey Sharp on this Hachita bike range in the middle of New Mexico, in the middle of nowhere. And other fellow riders arrive there, and you do basically three things. That's sleeping, that's eating, and that's chatting. That was that was a super good time. And then like 4 days later or something, I had my flight back home. And that was actually a super hard cultural shock, because you come back into normal life and you read news and you do just like normal things. And that was mentally, it was actually mentally for me harder to recover from this 2 weeks racing than it was physically.
Because, really?
Yeah. Wow. It was super demanding, because I did 2 weeks, nothing else than concentrating on those super basic things and having this kind of easy life, eating, sleeping, riding, taking care of resupply and fixing problems, but nothing besides that. And then you re-enter the normal world of like social life, of work, where people ask you things and you're still kind of tired and you still want to eat all the time and you still want to sleep all the time. And then all those social signals hit you from all sides. And that was super hard. And that was a thing that I struggled with for like another week or something. And that was a super rough time. But it was also the very first time. I mean, Tour Divide was my longest race ever as well. So it was the first time I experienced it in this way. And there was also this clear, the reason was clear that you had for 2 weeks nothing else than yourself, and then you reunite with like your normal social life, and it's just crazy. You definitely feel it.
Are you gonna do anything differently moving forward after big races like that, or do you have any things in place based on that experience?
I think one important or one good thing to handle it is just the fact to know that it happens like this. And when it happens the first time, it's you're questioning yourself what is happening. And also with like physiological signals like resting heart rate and stuff like this, I was concerned about my health, and I went to the doctor and got my blood values checked, and I thought like, yeah, there's definitely something wrong. And actually, the blood values were better than 4 weeks before the Tour Divide.
Huh.
So there was absolutely nothing wrong. I was even healthier.
Interesting.
Well, not healthier, but just the values were better.
Yeah.
I was not sick before or anything, but they didn't get worse or anything. And then you don't have explanations for it. You feel weak, you feel tired, you feel mentally broken, and you search for reasons. And one explanation was, yeah, there's probably something wrong. You will see it in the blood. And then there is nothing. And then I talked to a sports psychologist, and explained him what happened, and I explained him what I already checked, and he said, like, you know, from work there is this this thing people call burnout. And I was like, oh yeah, goddamn, I heard about it. And he asked me just one question. He asked me just, what did you do the last 2 weeks? And do you think it has something in common with issues that people experience that suffer burnout, like too much work and like overload of everything? And I was like, oh yeah. Oh yeah, I did this 14 consecutive days, maybe. And he said, like, yeah, just go home, rest up, give yourself a bit of time, and it will be fine. And it was fine after after a week or something. And so what changes the game when I experience it the next time? I know that it's part of the game. It can happen. And then you can treat it by just giving yourself the time to get over it. And what I did last year was basically kind of panicking and searching for an explanation for something which was just comparable with a burnout. Yeah. And it fixed itself within a few days. So there was no treatment, no medication, no nothing needed. It just needed a couple of days and then it's fine. And that's helping recovering from this kind of races if you know how your body reacts to certain things, and then you can act better on it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you say all that. This might be a bit of a unromantic perspective, but when I asked you earlier about why you keep coming back to these races, you know, you mentioned many of the things that I really enjoy about ultra, and you hear people mention as things that they really enjoy about ultra distance cycling, ultra distance running too, just ultra distance sports. But I have this kind of running theory that there's some brain chemistry stuff that happens too that is potentially kind of addictive in a way, where your brain is just lighting up in ways that it, like you were describing, it does not light up in these ways in any other version of life. I have only cried on the bike during these sorts of events, cried yes. out of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
The longest ones I've done is 2 or 3 days. I've never done anything nearly as long as what you've done. But the emotions, the highs and lows
yeah.
during, and then the emotions directly following, especially if you achieve something great, you know, the highs of winning the Tour Divide or meeting some huge goal are unparalleled,
yeah.
it seems like. And I kind of wonder if part of the addiction, so to speak, of this style of sport is in a way like an addiction, like the brain chemistry that's going on. And if potentially those really deep valleys that you hit post-event are kind of inevitable. Do you share that perspective at all? Do you think that like part of being a bike pack racer is that the tax for getting to experience such high highs is that you kind of have to pay the piper a little bit on the other side sometimes? Is it do you come across these emotional dips most of the time post-race?
Yeah. Not only post race, but also as you described during race. I'm not a person that starts crying out of sadness or happiness in daily life. I just, yeah, that's a sad thing, but I have to figure out a solution. I'm not, crying is not helping. I'm kind of not, I'm not a super emotional person, but on racing, I have like, I'm just riding normal. And then there is a sunrise. And there is a sunrise every day, but I start crying like totally, because the sunrise is so beautiful. And it's not a super beautiful sunrise. It's just an average sunrise. But in the moment, I just feel so emotional. That's the most beautiful sunrise I've ever seen in the last 2 days or whatever. And that's why I need to cry. And I definitely agree. So currently, the scientific opinion is that there is no addiction for sports defined, because like in the medical definition, an addiction is always something which is kind of destructive. Mm. So you can be addicted to drugs, which is obviously not healthy. You can be addicted to gambling, which ruins your social life, your financials and everything. So there's also something destructive. And addiction is always defined as something which is destructive. That's why in this definition, currently science says sports cannot be addictive. Mm. But still, I think that there are similarities. If you call it addiction or not, I think what happens in the brain chemistry on this kind of ultra long distance racing, or even in like normal distance racing in sports, it can be addictive because there are chemistry processes, whatever, they happen in the brain, and they are probably the same like if you gamble. You feel this high and you are like on top of it. And then you have to do another round and another round. And with the success, and also if you fail on gambling, you feel like, yeah, but if I try again, then it works better. And next time I'm better prepared. And I think there are parallels in racing as well. If you fail, you feel like, yeah, just I need another attempt. And then I can do this.
Yeah.
And I think the chemical processes or whatever is happening there, they are pretty similar.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I remember after Lachlan did his time trial on it this year, I asked him to do a podcast, and it was within 10 days of doing the ride. And I think just out of kind of being buddies and peers, he said yes, but he also said that he wasn't going to do any other interviews for a while. And I felt kind of guilty in hindsight, because he just needed to think about it for a while. He needed to think about the experience and go through that processing phase, which is really interesting. On Lachlan quickly, when we had coffee a couple of months ago, we were talking about his incredible ride, and you had some interesting perspectives about, you know, his record, whether it should count, all that sort of thing. We can talk about it if you want, but what I'm curious about is the sleep component, the fact that he slept so much, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
6 hours a night, I think. And whether that the athlete in you that's looking for marginal gains and constant improvement, did that give you any pause? Was that thought provoking for you, his approach?
I was already taking my Tour Divide approach last year. So before he did his one of my key components was proper sleep. Hmm. Because I thought on this long distance and like racing for more than 13, 14 days, I thought it's a bad idea to cut on sleep, especially in like the first 80-90% of the race. I thought if you want and if you need to cut, then you can try to cut in the last 10% or whatever. But before, it makes sense to not cut, because if you cut too early, then you might feel super bad in the middle of it and you lose a lot more time riding slow or just slacking, suffering, doing whatever, then investing an hour more of sleeping. So my philosophy was already having something like at least 4 hours in average per night. And I was experimenting with it, going a bit down, going a bit up, tested indoor versus outdoor sleeping, stuff like this, gained a lot of experience there. So I was already aware of the fact that, let's say, a good portion of sleep, it doesn't cost you, it's well invested. And you have a lot more fun riding and you can ride a lot more efficient because you're not feeling like, I need to stop. I want just to sit down for a minute. You just crush it. And this was already pretty well working for me. And then I was super curious to see what Lachlan did with his 6 hour that he said beforehand and said, I will stop 12 hours every 48. And in the end, it ended up being like six every night. And it was just fascinating to see how well it worked out, even that the conditions were as usual on these distances. I mean, we're talking 2,700 miles. There will something, some bad conditions will happen somewhere on the way. And I mean, the pace he was able to maintain, that was just, it was amazing to see how it worked out. And I think it was a much better approach than trying to only sleep, I don't know, 3 hours a night and then suffering through the day. And so I think everyone has his has its own sleeping sweet spot kind of thing where he or she could perform best. And everyone needs to find it individually.
Yeah. What is your sweet spot roughly?
I think something between 4 and 5 hours.
Yeah. Nice. I've got so much more I'd like to talk to you about, but we'll do another one at some point. I do want to talk about your plans for this year because they're pretty unique. You are making progress quickly, recovering from this injury. Sounds like you said you did 2 hours today, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is it fair to say that your plans for this year are not derailed per se?
No, definitely. Definitely not. I mean, we're still end of February. My main racing season will be in June and later on this year. So there is plenty of time to prepare for it. And my main and my big plan for this year is a project called the Triple Crown Challenge. So what I would love to do is to race the Tour Divide, the Colorado Trail, and the Arizona Trail, all with the Grand Departs in one calendar year. So Tour Divide in mid of June, Colorado Trail is mid-August, and Arizona Trail mid-October, all of them this year, gives me, let's say, a pretty solid racing calendar.
Yep.
And that's in total more than 6,000 kilometer, more than 3,300 miles or something of racing in wild and rugged terrain. And yeah, really looking forward to those adventures. And there's still plenty of time to prepare them.
Yeah. So why have you decided to tackle this Triple Crown? I mean, obviously you tell me, but it seems like the highest profile, big challenge that a bike pack racer can set for themselves at this point. But there's also so many incredible events in Europe these days. I mean, there's bike packing is exploding like many other parts of the sport. So someone that's based in Europe going over and making the majority of your season in the United States is no small commitment. Why have you decided to dive into that?
Well, I think I've done racing in Europe in a lot of countries the last years, and I've seen a lot over here, and there is always like the more far away it is, the more exciting it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you are here in Girona as well.
That's true.
Because if it's far away, it's more exciting. And that's the same for me. And that's one reason. And last year, doing Tour Divide, I was simply totally fascinated by the landscape, by the variety. It just blew me away. And I had the Colorado Trail and the Arizona Trail on my list for a long, long time. And my first thoughts were about doing one of them this year. And then I thought, I had somewhere on the list also the Triple Crown, and then it was just kind of a logical process for me that I thought, I have already done Tour Divide. If I now do, for example, Colorado Trail, and at some point I want to do this Triple Crown challenge, I have to do two of the races again. And so it was kind of a logical process, at least in my weird mind, to say, okay, this year I only have to do Tour Divide again, and then can do the other two big trails, and basically just check them all. And that's my reason why I personally want to do it like in this fashion. And I think it's Tour Divide was just amazing, and I would love to go back and see the route again from a different perspective. And Colorado, Arizona, everything I saw so far is just mind-blowing. It's something totally different. I mean, Arizona Trail includes hiking the Grand Canyon with a dismantled bike on your back, rim to rim, which is 26 miles, 42 kilometers hiking with like 20 kilograms of a bike on your back, which is not allowed to touch the ground. That's another out of context unique story you will not find anywhere else. And that's so fascinating. I mean, I love hiking. I love riding my bike. I find the combination of both at the same time, it's weird. But still, that's fun, kind of. And probably if you have done it, you really feel you have achieved something afterwards. And that is what keeps me going, just to sit back, I don't know, end of October and hopefully say, that was a good year, and I've managed to do them all. And yeah, that's what I'm working towards now.
That's awesome. Breaking news.
Breaking news, yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait to follow. Man, there's so many more follow-up questions I have and things I'd love to talk about, but we'll have to do another episode sometime. Luckily, you're going to be on my side of the pond a good bit.
Yeah.
In the coming months.
True.
Okay, man. Anything else you want to touch on this episode before we call it a night?
I think we're good for today.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're healing up, and appreciate you taking the time. It's really fun to get a window into your mindset with all of this and see how you're taking a little bit of a different approach compared to some of your competitors.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks, Ulrich. We'll catch you again soon.
Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ulrich. As a reminder, you can always check out the video to go along with this audio at my YouTube. That's just Payson McKelvin. As well as little reels, little snippets of the conversation on our Instagram, The Adventure Stash, as well as our Friday quizzes where you can win some fun socks, play some games, engage with other fans of the show, shoot us messages if you have ideas, thoughts, feedback, all that sort of thing. We stay up to date there on those channels as much as we can. I want to say a big, big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show. It's been really wonderful to have her here in Girona for a week. I didn't say at the top of the show, I should have. She was in the room during this conversation with Ulrich, which is really fun. Also a big thank you to Nicole Baker for producing the show. She does everything from running the cameras to helping with scheduling, keeping my head on straight, coming up with questions, how we want to tackle these conversations, everything in between. And thanks to you, the listeners, for always staying engaged. We will keep these rolling each and every week. Thank you for your notes as always. They mean a lot. And we will catch you next week.